I should just say that I have transitioned to Liberty University as of August 1st. So thank you. We're also pleased to announce that as of last Friday, the faculty voted to adopt the Master of Arts in Ethnomusicology degree. And we also have a Master of Arts in Worship Studies with a minor or specialization in Ethnomusicology, if you have any questions about that. I chose the title Oxymoron Music Missionary because whenever somebody asks me, what do you do for a living, if I tell them ethnomusicologist, it usually ends the conversation. If I say music missionary, they look at me like, is that really such a thing, a possibility, that a musician could actually be a missionary? And I've always been somewhat astounded by that. Why does that seem so ludicrous to a person? Well, maybe it's because we haven't developed enough theological credibility with people on that side, or maybe it's because their concept of what they've observed in music missions is somebody going on a short-term concert tour to Germany, singing several songs in English, and coming home and never making contact with a person from Germany directly. So they don't understand what an ethnomusicologist or a music missionary really is, or could or should be doing. So really what it comes down to is that it isn't working again. I have no idea. I've been through this thing at least a half a dozen times just since last night.
Well, we have a handout.
Sure. Let's just go ahead and go. Let me say, first of all, why ethnomusicology and what is it we're really talking about here when we talk about ethnomusicology? Let me explain to you the difference. There are three terms that tend to be thrown around. One is ethnomusicology and the other is ethnodoxology. The second term, ethnodoxology, simply is the work of the Christian ethnomusicologist. And I think as we see that term develop, we'll see that it not only is the ethnomusicologist, but the ethno-artist, and it begin to involve all the arts. And we're seeing that already begin to expand. And ethnomusicology, I suppose if you look, just dissect the term, we're talking about ethnic music study, or the study of ethnic music cultures. The difference between ethnomusicology and musicology essentially is that in musicology, we tend traditionally to study the music. In ethnomusicology, we study the music in the context of its culture. In other words, we're looking at the music culture, not necessarily the analysis of the music, but how it functions in the cultural context. And we're starting to find a merging of these two, even in secular universities, so that we see them working together. There's a third term that I usually bring into play, and that's ethnocentricity, which is a self-centered approach, or interpreting everything else by our own concepts of what our culture is. So it tends to involve judgment, whereas ethnomusicology is more the analytical approach. What is the function in the music culture? Ethnocentricity is evaluating or judging. So if a student hands a paper into my class, one of the things they're always graded on is, did you avoid ethnocentric evaluation of that culture in your study? So we're trying to remove an ethnocentric bias from that. Frankly, it's probably somewhat nigh unto impossible to totally do that. In the same way, that it's probably impossible to really become what we call bimusical, that is, completely culturally sensitive to two different music cultures. Same thing with the concept of bilingual. Unless you have been raised as a member of that culture, you may speak the language pretty well, even without accent, but you don't necessarily understand the culture itself. There's a very famous chapter in one of the ethnomusicology books that says, you will never be one of us because you aren't one of us. So what we're trying to do is look at music in the context of that culture as a function. Now, it's a very difficult concept to explain to Westerners. What do we mean by functional music? Because we've so taken music out of its cultural context. The closest I can come to you is Christmas carols. If you're in church and you sing Joy to the World, the Lord has come in your service in June, people look at you as though you've lost your senses to some extent. And I like to do that anyway. I would say, why should we celebrate the Joy to the World only in December? But there's something about Christmas carols, secular or sacred carols, that tends to put us in the context of knowing that that's Christmas. So people say to me, oh, I just love when I start hearing Christmas carols because it just puts me in the mood of the season. Well, it really doesn't, unless you choose it to. And it also doesn't mean you necessarily understand it. So my personal experience then, look at that. We've already been through this. As started to see the growth of this. Now, there are certainly some people that were on the field doing this kind of work, either formally or informally, even back in the 50s. Vida Chenoweth was one of the forerunners. Roberta King, who is now at Fuller, has done a lot of the original work in this area. S.I.L. Wycliffe has done probably the most significant strategic organized work in ethnomusicology with missions. But what we're seeing is a real history of change in this. I was at Urbana for the first time in 1993. I called because I wanted to exhibit with our nonprofit, Music and World Cultures, and they said, well, we don't have a category for music or ethnomusicology. What are we going to do? I said, you start one. Well, it was too late that year. But in 96, I noticed when we went the second time, they now had a category for ethnomusicology. And we presented four sessions on ethnomusicology. In 2000, I went back. Not only were there 27 different sessions on music and missions and the arts and missions, there were now 95 different mission agencies that had checked off in the column ethnomusicology music as searching for people to serve with their mission agency. We know now that there are 900 Christian elementary schools in Latin America who are looking for a music teacher, elementary schools. So there are plenty of places to work. We just need to prepare the people. In 2006, the last time I went to Urbana, they had now actually established a specific arts track for artists who were interested in mission, and over 200 were attending the sessions on ethnomusicology or music and mission. So this is a very fast growing field, and we're excited about that. So why do we do this? Well, number one, we already defined that, and we defined that, and we're going to look at this. One is that even in our own country, we have this upsurge of ethnic awareness. You only needed to look at the elections yesterday to see the influence of the cultural diversity in this country. Just in Minneapolis, St. Paul, where I happen to live, there are over 700,000 people who are non-European in their descendancy, or who are non-European in their descendancy. Asian, Native American, Latin American or Hispanic, and African-American, over 700,000. In the Twin Cities of Minneapolis-St. Paul, there are now over 200 languages spoken. It's causing quite an interesting dilemma for some of the school systems, I might add. What happens in this kind of a situation is what in ethnomusicology we call globalization, localization. That is, the more global we come, the more we tend to become ethnically localized. So if you go to Minneapolis-St. Paul, here are these 700,000 people who are non-European descent, and they're all living in little, small, local segments. So Northeast, here are 40,000 Hmong. Southwest, here are 20 or 30,000 Hispanics. Over here, you have the African Americans. Over here, you have a Polish contingent that's been there for 150 years, but they're still localized. And we find this all over. This idea that the more global we become, the more localized we become. We find the same thing with missionaries. I have one graduate student that went to Africa and interviewed and surveyed all the missionaries from one specific mission agency. Not one missionary was attending the national church. They had to localize in that international church. That's the one thing they just couldn't give up, was their musical culture. They'd given up their language and everything else. So what do we deal with when we talk about this? Well, we have to understand that when we deal with a music culture, we're looking at how any specific local group, ethnic or otherwise, views its involvement with music or how it is involved with music. We're essentially a musical anthropologist, realizing that most cultures in the world do not even have a vocabulary for music. Why? They never study it. They just make it. So we use the term in ethnomusicology. What are they doing? They are musicking. They are making music. So we have to deal with the issue of contextualization. When we deal with contextualization, what are we talking about? What we're saying is, how appropriate is it to use the local arts for worship, discipleship, and evangelism? Now, we know we go in and learn the language. we go in and translate the scriptures in their language, but somehow we've still failed to use the indigenous arts. And the statistical data that I've heard from a variety of what I would call leading missionary or missiologists around the country is as many as 90% of the missionaries are still taking in the Western song. One of my absolutely funniest, craziest, wildest experience when I was working in the jungle in Indonesia, first recording some of their music, a lady came up to me and she said, "Listen," she said, "I know you've been recording all of our songs, but I'm sure no one has sung this for you. This is one of our very favorite oldest songs. Could I please sing it for you and have you record it?" And I said, "Sure." I turned on my tape and she sang, "Blessed assurance, Jesus is mine," etc., the whole thing through. This particular island is referred to in the travel guide as the last bastion of true primitivism on earth. And here, the missionary, I thought was going to pass out. Somewhere, somehow, on a boat came by or whatever, and taught them that song. And she was singing that out here in the middle of the jungle. It didn't bear any resemblance to any of their other music. But she had thought that that was an original song that had been passed down by their ancient ancestors. Well, when we deal with contextualization, we have to realize that music is not a universal language. That's a great myth. In the same way that there are different spoken languages, there are different musical languages, and we have to deal with that. If I went to the piano and tried to play the Indonesian scale, one of the two primary scales, the Pelog or the Slendro, I can't do it because the intervals are different, and that's true with many other areas as well. We have to realize that to a culture, music is the most important language next to speech, and in fact, if you want to look at the new book out by Dan Levitin called This Is Your Brain on Music, he contends that music is more important to us as a cultural identity than our spoken language because of the way the brain is made up. Let me just give you some examples of why this is an important issue. Because we have to deal with, are we going to contextualize their worship or their arts form and use it as a Christian form? A missionary came up to me at Urbana and said, "Really glad to hear what you people are starting to do now with music." He said, "The missionaries in a neighboring village of ours had planted a church, and they decided that this church they should start singing. And of course, they automatically assumed that all of their old music was evil. Probably because they didn't understand, or legitimately because they only observed it in the pagan types of worship forms. So they decided that they should have these people singing. So they took the hymn, How Great Thou Art. Thought this is certainly one that the people ought to be singing in church, and every Sunday they faithfully sang How Great Thou Art. But the missionaries never processed the fact that the language was a tonal language. You understand a tonal language is the tone changes the meaning of the word. So they're singing every Sunday morning, O Lord my God, when I am awesome wonder, but the tone changed the meaning of the words to unlucky old man, when I an awesome wonder, but they're faithfully singing it because that's what the missionaries said that we should do. We call this no contextualization. Paul Hebert calls this no contextualization in his book, Insight for Missionaries. What does he mean? All the old arts must be bad. Then we have what we call non-critical contextualization. This is where you don't make any evaluation, all you let them continue what they want. And what we're finding is this tends to facilitate or stimulate or act as a catalyst for syncretism. They bring the two together. Whereas no contextualization tends to lead to the subversion of the old belief system. In other words, they operate in the church, but they keep the old system going. Hebert suggests, and I concur with, the idea of critical contextualization. You work with the people in the process of discipleship to see which of their arts would be appropriate to use in the Christian expressions of faith. There was a missionary that came to me I happened to be acquainted with, and we met in the airport in Indonesia, actually. I was going one way, he was going the other. Oh, he said, "I got to tell you what happened to me." He said, "You know, we'd had a church planted for 10 years in our tribe, and our people weren't singing. And he'd been to these missionary conferences, and all the missionaries were talking about their people singing. He said, I felt bad, so I thought I should go back and help my people sing." Well, mistake number one, he didn't recognize what they were doing as music because it was a different language than he was used to. The mistake number two, he decided he would translate the hymn, Nearer My God to Thee. So he spent the morning teaching them the words, and he thought, these are good words. They said, we will practice them. This was in the Philippines. And so he said, good, now I'd like to teach you how to sing it. And so he did. And they said, well, now stop. He said, what? He said, you got to make up your mind. He said, what do you mean? He said, are we supposed to get nearer to God or farther? And it hit him. To say the word near and far was identical depending on the pitch inflection. So when he tried to set the hymn nearer to God, the music made it change to farther. So they were saying get nearer to God, but they were singing get farther from him. Another missionary came up to me from Kalimantan. He said, we need help really bad. He said, the entire second generation of believers is leaving the church. All the youth, fleeing back to the old religion. I said, why? He said, well, they came to us and they said, look, if indeed you brought us a universal God and we can speak to him in our language, why can't we sing to him in our language? The missionary said, well, let's make some songs. He said, no, he said, it's too late. You've deceived us. You haven't really brought us a universal God. You've brought us an American God and American songs, and we're not interested in either. We're going back to the old religion. Then there was a missionary in Africa that decided a good hymn to translate would be, Hide Me, O My Savior, Hide Me. Most of you probably don't remember that hymn. You're not old enough. I remember it because my dad used to do it as a duet with another wonderful singer. And so they translated that hymn, and it came out, Skin Me, O My Savior, Skin Me. But they sang it because that's what the missionaries said they should do. My friend Roberta King went to Ivory Coast for the first time, and she was studying the Sanufro people there and went to their church, which had been planted. And the first Sunday she was there and the drums started. They, of course, announced the song that's coming, telling the people to get there late because they want to start. And they announced the song with the drum, and the people started singing. And as they started singing, they clapped because they're picking up one of the drum rhythms. And they started standing up, and they started up and down the aisle in this long dance line. And all the missionaries were sitting in the front row, arms crossed, feet crossed, absolutely frozen, because they hadn't been able to deal with the sinful dancing yet. Well, afterwards, my friend, the ethnomusicologist, was thanked profusely for worshiping with the people. They said, you're the first missionary that's ever worshiped with us. What's wrong with the other missionaries? Do they have sin in their lives? And she discovered that in this particular culture, if you refused to dance, it was a silent public confession of sin. So here were the missionaries who'd planted the church, led the people of the Lord, but refusing to worship with them because they had sin in their lives. So that's why it's so important to study what all these little subliminal and secondary meanings to their cultural form are. I think the thing that we need to remember is that to these people, that is part of their identity. You know, there's a difference between an ethnic Jew and a religious Jew. And Xiaoming in China is a woman, and I think she's about 34 now. She's composed over 1,000 original Chinese songs for worship. This is what she said. When I sing your songs, the Western songs, I am part of God's people around the world. But when I sing my songs, I feel God in my heart. So there's a different kind of connections that made. And I've experienced the same kind of thing in Indonesia when I work with the people in the jungle. We want to sing one of your songs, they would say, but they never sing when I'm not there. What they sing that for is it's a means of saying there are people on another island that believe like we do. And they're amazed that there are brothers and sisters of Christ in other places. So we must remember that music is amoral. That shakes a lot of people up. And I'm going to explain to you why it does right here. First of all, we have music, which has its affect. By that we mean it's aesthetic, it's beauty, it's power to move us. So if I say to you, we're going to sing Just As I Am without one plea, you think I am at where? Billy Graham meeting. Now, have you ever tried to open a service with that song? I did one time, instead of closing the service. I opened the service. I had notes in the offering plate, telephone calls, people meeting me in the hallway. Why did you sing that song there? I said, well, can you think of a better way to come into worship than to sing Just As I Am without one plea, O Lamb of God, I come? It should only be at the end of the service. Why? Because that's what they had learned through their experience. Well, the performer's job in the performance is to bring about or recreate that affect. That's done very well at Billy Graham meetings. But we have the audience. By the audience, we mean all those consumers of music, the entire community of consumers of music. They make the rules. What do I mean? Well, if you want to earn a living, you better write what they want. If you want to grow your church, you better sing what they sing. I've actually had Christian composers come to me and say that they write what they know will sell. These people also are important because they determine what that music means. They interpret the style of music, what it means to them. So you can't make a person worship and you can't make a person like a song or understand it. They have to decide that themselves. And they do that based upon their experience with it. So what happens is that music occurs in a specific time and place associated with an event. So we know that Just As I Am occurs at that Billy Graham meeting in the end. And as soon as that first note starts, people stand up and they start coming forward. People either like or dislike or know about that song based upon their experience with it. When and where we experience a musical event establishes in us a memory history. That memory history is locked in. That is formed no later than 18 years old. Research indicates that a child has memorized all the rules of music by age 5 in the brain. That memory history then tends to develop in us our response to any musical form. So here's an example, which I use with permission, of my wife, who was raised in a non-Christian home, who for years as a high school student went on Friday nights, 7 to 8 bars, to play piano for her father, even though she was a believer and not involved in that part. She had no choice but what to go. Along with that came all sorts of abuses, one of which was violence. Well, many, many years later, we'd been married at this point at least 30 years, we're sitting in church service where I was going to be presenting, and we got there early so we could get our minds together and prepared for the service. And out on the platform came 3 musicians, keyboard, drum set, and saxophone. By the 5th note, I looked out of my eye and the tears were streaming down her face. Why? She knows that there's nothing evil about the keyboard, nothing evil about the drum set, and nothing evil about the saxophone. But that time-space event had created such a strong memory history, it was so unexpected to see that same trio that she had played with, the instrumentation, that she, without even thinking, was thrust back to that event. And on that particular Sunday, had almost an impossible time getting beyond that to worship God because it was such a shock. That time-space memory history is the strongest thing we have. What do we mean by that? That time-space memory history creates for us the meaning of music or the affect. So if we go to church and we like the music, we say we've had a wonderful music experience. If we don't, we haven't had, or I'm sorry, a wonderful worship experience. If we don't like the music, we say, worship today I just didn't really enjoy. Well, what are we really saying? That we probably went to church or came away from church expecting an aesthetic or musical experience and not necessarily a worship one. So I use the verse Exodus 33:32 for that. You are to them like a sensual song sung by one who has a beautiful voice, through the coming of a fine instrumentalist. For they hear your words, but they don't practice them. In other words, they love the music, but nothing happened. So we refer to this as saying that music is amoral, but because of our time, space, memory, history, we attribute morality to it. Hence, all the controversy of what music we should or should not use in the church, based upon our cultural experience. We have then 4 phases of an ethnomusicologist's work. The first of those is pre-evangelism or evangelism, and often we're working with a team at this point. What we're doing is, with music, we're breaking down barriers, we're building bridges with music and establishing relationships. Through this pre-evangelist experience, we learn a people's worldview. They embody their belief system and their religious practices in their music and their arts. And through this, we can find cultural keys. For example, a couple of years ago, I was in China. We're doing a survey of China to see where our students might work and where we might work with the house church movement. And we had the opportunity to meet with five Nashe musicians. These are the ancient musicians. We're talking instruments that they're using that are 80, 90, 100 years old, playing the most ancient forms, not the touristy stuff. And so we arranged for a command performance for my translator and I for 2.5 hours. It was the two of us and the five of them. And they said, we're going to play a 7-act opera for you. And they said, this is the most famous story of our people. Well, that's great, we said. And now he said, part of it is on the deets of this flute. And I said to him, because I had studied just a few phrases in Mandarin so that I could appear at least a halfway non-touristy. And I said to him, oh, wo yo bagaditsa, I have 8 of those flutes. And he said, oh, wow, Mandarin, that was great. Well, that just opened up the floodgates and just went on and on and on. Well, movement number one, he said, is about the battle between the East and West tribes. Now, the battle, he said, was so bloody that the blood in the water flowed in the river and became one. And I looked at my friend and I said, excuse me, did we just get a gospel analogy? He said, I think so. Second movement. The princess of one of the emperors is so upset about the battle that she pricks her finger and with her own shed blood writes a letter pleading for the peace of the people. I said, excuse me, did we just get a second gospel analogy? He said, I think so. The third movement. All the sheep on the hillside, all right, there's our animal imagery, the Lamb of God, the Good Shepherd, etc. The final movement, a prayer for the souls of the dead that they might return to the clouds from whence they came. And my translator turned to me and said, now I know what it is an ethnomusicologist does. So in a matter of 2.5 hours, we had 4 key cultural connections with which we could eventually present the gospel if we established a work there. That's that pre-evangelistic phase. The other is establishing relationships. Well, certainly we did that with this group, a particular group of people. We have another student who worked in Kyrgyzstan. And he decided that since he was going there, he should learn to play one of their instruments. So he took some lessons on a komuz, which is a 3-string instrument, which we would relate to either the American banjo or perhaps the Russian balalaika. And so he'd been over there for a couple of years in his first term and was on an airplane going to a conference of missionaries, which, of course, are illegal in that country. And he decided to take his komuz along with him, along with a song he'd written, Psalm 139, stuck in his back pocket. And so they're on the plane, and he gets on the plane, and sitting next to him is an obvious Muslim holding a komuz. So he strikes up a conversation with him. The guy says, you're an American, aren't you? He said, yeah. He says, how come you're speaking Kyrgyz? Because they expect Americans to, if they speak anything at all, to speak Russian because it's so much more a universal language over there. Well, he said, because I'm in Kyrgyzstan. Well, I said, you speak very well. And then Bond said, excuse me, he said, I notice you're holding a komuz. And the guy said, whoa, wait a minute. He says, you're not American, are you? Really? Yeah, yeah. He says, all right, you speak Kyrgyz and you know what a komuz is. You can't possibly be an American. America would never know that. Yeah, Bond says, I've got my komuz up in the luggage rack. The guy says, no kidding. Where are you staying when you get into town? Well, he said, I'm staying at such and such a hotel. And the guy says, I live across the street. I'll be over tonight. So he invites himself over to the hotel. And he brings his komuz. And he sits here and plays a whole concert for Von in his hotel room. It turns out he's the number one folk singer in the entire country. Then he says to Von, all right, I want to hear you play. Certainly you've composed a song. See, it's assumed if you play the komuz, you sing and compose. You don't separate them. Von said, well, no, I'm not going to play for you. The guy says, yeah, you'll play for me. He says, I want to hear you. You speak Kyrgyz and you got a komuz. Let me hear you sing. So he whips it out and he sings Psalm 139. The guy says, wow, he says, this is absolutely pure. He said, there's no American fluency here at all. He says, you may be American, but in here you're Kyrgyz. Now he says, tomorrow night you come to my house. So Von says, okay, and next night he goes to his house. He's got together 25 of the top musicians in the whole country, and they have a 3-hour jam session, all Muslims. By the way, are you aware that the Quran forbids music? But that's who they are, so they do it anyway. Now, I get to the end of this little jam session, and the guy says, okay, Von, play your song for them. So in a matter of 24 hours, he's singing Psalm 139 to 25 Muslims, who, if they knew he was a Christian missionary, would at least run him out of the country, if not kill him. That's that breaking down the barrier and establishing the kind of relationship. That's what we do. In some cases, we might actually analyze their music to a way we could sing the stories of Jesus in their musical style. Tom Avery, who unfortunately died this year, did a marvelous thing with that with the Canela people in Brazil. So the second aspect then is worship. Here we're talking about making music to God. Do we use the American hymn or do we use the indigenous? And I think here what we have to do is that idea of critical contextualization again. I work with the Tugutio people in Halmahera, Indonesia. They have an ancestral taboo against music. Music is forbidden. You cannot sing or play an instrument because music angers the evil spirits. Isn't that interesting? Because Ephesians 5 says if you are filled with God's Spirit, you make music to God. Well, the people came to the missionary and said, look, we got to talk. And he said, what? He said, look, now that we have God's Spirit on us, he said, we got to sing. We can't keep it anymore or our guts are going to burst all over the ground. And he said, well, go ahead and sing. He said, well, what about the taboo? Oh, he reviewed then the idea of the sovereignty of God. He said, oh, they were embarrassed. We're bad thinking. We forgot about that. All right, what are we going to sing? And he said, well, what do you want to sing? Well, we don't have any songs. All right, let's make some. So they decided they would come up with text first. And their first song has 15 verses. And it goes from the creation through the ascension. Evidently, they hadn't taught the second coming yet. And he said, okay, well, we got words, but how do we sing? He said, our missionary said, I don't know. Just sing. So they opened their mouth and out came this phenomenal stuff, which I have on tape recording. And it's just wonderful. And that's an ethnocentric statement, but it's still wonderful. And now they're singing. And I was there working with them not long after that. And they at that point had like 21 or 22 songs. And I had a chance to interview the shaman who enforced the taboo. And in the process of that interview, I asked him if he'd ever seen music was written on paper. No, he said, I haven't. I said, would you like to? He said yes and invited me to come sing, so I went and sat by him and showed it to him, and I said, would you like me to sing this for you? Yes, he said, I would. Now, bear in mind, the missionaries had been there 15 years, never been able to have a conversation with him. So I sang to him in his own language the tribal equivalent to O Holy Night, the Christmas carol. Now, his wife and daughter become believers. He went through Bible studies, but what he's done is he took what he learned out of Bible studies, combined it with his own religion, removed the taboo of singing so that hopefully he can start his own church and still have his own power center. So we're still praying for Opuhu, who is his name. The island of Taliabo, now they have over 200 original songs, and I don't have time to sing those for you or go through the whole thing. The next thing that we do in the four phases is the issue of discipleship. Ephesians 5 says, if you've got God's Spirit, you'll make music to God. We look at that as a mandate for worship. Colossians 3 says, teach and admonish with psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. This is not an option. It's a biblical mandate for music and Christian education. This has to do with teaching doctrine. It has to do with teaching Christian living. It has to do with Scripture memory. Particularly in the oral tradition, music is the system of memorization. So you give a teaching in a service, and by that afternoon you'll hear them singing it. Because they'll make a song to help them remember that. Kala, my friend in Taliabo, will sing the book of Ephesians to you if you would like. By the way, the armor of God in Ephesians 6 is the same equipment that the shaman uses in demon possession ritual. So we can tell and remember the biblical stories. And we also know that when they sing a song back to us, they've learned how we taught that lesson. So I sat one day with a song, and I ran it by the missionary. I said, would you check this over to make sure that it's right? He said, you have the wrong text. I said, that's the words you gave me. He said, that's the wrong words. I said, here's the paper where you wrote it. He said, that's terrible. He said, on the surface, it seems okay, but that one phrase is from the old religious system and has a secondary meaning. I said, well, here's the tape recording from Sunday service where it was sung. I played it for the composer. He said, where did you get that? I said, it's the song you led Sunday. He said, we'll reteach it next week. So we learn, it's like a test, what they've learned based upon what they sing back to us. And then we use music for evangelism. What's interesting is I can't find any place in Scripture where we're told or where there's an example of using music as an evangelistic tool. There are all sorts of examples of worshiping God in front of non-believers. And the true worship of God always seems to be evangelistic in nature. That is to say, when people hear the stories clearly, they tend to accept them. The Taliabo people have decided that they should share. So they've done three complete music dramas, all original compositions. One is Elijah and the Prophets of Baal. Next one is the Advent. And the third one is the Passion. Unfortunately, they haven't learned a lot about abstract acting yet. So they almost beat the poor person who played Jesus beyond repair. And I've had a little bit difficult time getting someone else to play the part since then. There are a lot of things that you can't say, but a lot of things that you can sing or play. Last August, we arranged for Roger Frisch, the Associate Concertmaster of Minnesota Orchestra, to go to China on a tour. He performed a concerto with the Hunan Symphony, which, by the way, is led by a house church leader who also happens to be the head of instrumental music for all the colleges and universities of China. Then they asked him if he would be willing to do a recital for the opening convocation of the Hunan University, and he said, sure. So with 1,500 students and the entire faculty, he played a recital. And then they asked him if he'd be willing to answer questions. And he said, sure. Well, tell us about yourself. So he shared what he did as a musician and about his little trio that plays in Ukraine and other places. And they said, and in the meantime, he slipped the word in for Chinese word for peace. And they said to him, well, how do you get inner peace? And he looked at Timothy, the Chinese conductor, and Timothy goes, yeah, go ahead. So he shared with him his entire story of faith. How he had accepted Christ, forgiveness for sin, and how his inner peace now came from the indwelling of the Holy Spirit in China, in a secular university. At the end, they thanked him profusely for coming and said, come back anytime. That was last August. A week ago, he just returned from his second trip, performing at several other universities in China, because he was accepted as a musician and able, therefore, to get in through that. Now, what I've got here for you are some video examples of what I've been talking about. Which, if I have this right, will work. And this ethnomusicologist can have some very interesting experiences. This is called the second most famous landing in the world. The airplane you're looking at is a single-engine Piper Cub. The sides of the airplane and the wings are covered with canvas. I mean cloth canvas. You're sitting on a piece of plywood behind the pilot on a cushion. And I'm holding the camera at this point. And right coming up here, here's the airstrip. It's on a 23-degree slope on the side of the mountain. We have to drop approximately 2,000 feet down to land. The problem is when we come in, there's a mountain in the way. So he has to come in like this, and his final approach is at a right angle. As we get there, there's your airstrip right there. Missionary's house up here in these white spots. This is their school. This is their church. This people are the Lao Tse people. The missionaries that I stayed with are the first white people that ever managed to live here, because if you're white, they assume you don't have any blood, which means you must be a spirit. Because if you had blood, obviously your skin would have color in it. So they would ask you a question. If you can't answer the question in their language, then they assume you're an evil spirit. And by their belief system, if they can take your head off before you put the curse on them as an evil spirit, they're protected from it. By the way, it's not an easy language. Low A, below the treble staff, they would say, which means a little round thing and a second little short thing underneath all the lines and keep going. They don't tend to name things, they describe everything. You want to have an interesting musical lesson to teach, try that one. So the airplane now is descending, going down the river. He'll make another U-turn, come back. He makes a right turn and then a left turn. He has less than 2 seconds from level to touchdown. Now he's turned around and we have the airstrip right here. And I'm saying to myself, excuse me, Jim, sir, the airship's over there. Of course, I didn't talk because at this point I'd been told by other missionaries, when you get on the plane and he gets his point, don't say anything and don't ask any questions. Now he's making his final approach. The airstrip on the left there, as you can see. And you notice at this point I'm starting to photograph out of the window on the top of the airplane. It's about 40 or 50 feet wide, about 300 feet long. Now we're down.
Where is this?
Sulawesi, Indonesia. Way up in the northwest corner. This is the takeoff. And I always have to lean with him. He can't climb yet because he doesn't have enough airspeed. So he gets around the mountain and then eventually he gets up. This next shot that's coming up here is from Ukraine. We started working in Ukraine in 1997. The communists confiscated all music instruments, declared them works of art, and in so doing said that it was illegal for Christians or non-Christians to own an instrument. They didn't want artists expressing themselves. Well, we're over here and just doing a survey again, and Roger Fish, that Minnesota orchestra guy, had been over here doing a recital tour. He said, you've got to go help these musicians. So we went. And this is my son, Stephen, at the piano, who's now running the nonprofit for us, Music and World Cultures. And Sasha Kreschuk, who's our primary liaison, he's the head of instrumental or head of music for the entire Baptist Union of Ukraine, which, by the way, since Perestroika, has grown from 900 churches to 3,000 churches. And we said to him, what are your dreams? He said, well, first of all, I want a Christian orchestra because we feel that we can have a tremendous impact on the intelligentsia. You see, the Christians were always publicized as being illiterate, stupid hill people who didn't have enough brains. In fact, they were even taught in the public schools that the Baptists sacrificed their children in their worship services, anything they could to keep people from becoming Christian. So that was his dream, and Stephen said, well, if you really want an orchestra, here's what you need. 8 first violins, 8 second violins, 4 violas, 2 cellos, 4 cellos, bass, 3 trumpets, 4 horns, 3 trombones, etc., etc., the woodwinds. And Sasha just sank. He said, I honestly don't think there are that many Christian musicians in the entire country because their instruments were confiscated. But about 3 months later, Stephen got a call at 3 o'clock in the morning. They don't have a concept of how far away we are. Stephen, yeah, this is Sasha. We're ready. He said, what do you mean? He said, well, I found 8 first violins, 8 second violins, 4 violas, 4 cellos, string bass, 3 trumpets, etc., the whole thing. He said, they'll be here next week for rehearsal. Can you be here? Well, Stephen's working on his doctorate at Eastman. He said, well, you know, you just don't give a week's notice over here. We don't do things that way. Well, Sasha thought he was planning way ahead. Because in Russia, you plan one morning when you get up because you never know what's going to happen the next day to your plans. So arranged to come over in January and started in 1997 this youth orchestra movement. First of all, with an adult group who became teachers and planted now 20 schools of music. Now, 10 years later, we were just told this spring by the Ukrainian Baptist Union that they estimate there are now 10,000 children studying music formally in music schools in Ukraine, and they're winning all the national contests. Remember, I told you about establishing relationships. This is the first week we were in Ukraine, our first trip. I said, do you have a balalaika player? And you're going to see some interesting confusion here. This guy plays the balalaika. He brought a piece of music for Stephen. Stephen doesn't speak Ukrainian or Russian at this point. He doesn't speak a word of English. And it's just interesting to watch the process develop. You know, she said, stay out of it. The musicians are working here. It's like they're playing two totally different pieces of the music. I think what's happened is this guy has played this so many years without accompaniment, he's sort of developed his own understanding of how it goes. You notice that the people sitting in the room are starting to get into it a little bit too. They're saying, hey, this is going okay. This guy's part Ukrainian. And after this, we were referred to as Ukrainian Americans, and they started giving us Ukrainian names. This is why you practice scales. So they're just speaking their own language, but they got it figured out now. One of those preachers in this church now is a converted ex-KGB agent. It's always interesting teaching a class when you know you have KGB sitting in your... This is Taliabu, Indonesia. This is the church where animistic ex-headhunting groups, you now have four clans who for generations fought and took each other's heads, worshiping together in one church. They sing antiphonally in four corners, answering back and forth. It just sends shivers up and down your back. This is their lead singer. Everybody yearns to sing as well as she does. I first described her voice as sounding as though someone had taken a pair of vice grips and clamped it on her larynx before she started singing. Yet this is to them the most beautiful sound in the world. They'll sing a four-octave unison. It is just powerful. And we started teaching with them music literacy simply because they asked, how do you sing with us like that? And they could see me writing the music down. So they said, teach us how to do that. After 5 weeks of music lessons spread over a 12-month, 14-month span, they can now sit and write down their own songs melodically and rhythmically, something that a lot of freshman music majors are challenged to do. We don't usually do this for two reasons. We don't want to change their system, but their system was compatible with ours to a great extent. So they learned how to read. They said they want to sing one of our songs. It became one of the games. The other game was when a missionary would come over, they'd say to the missionary, sit down. And he'd sit down and they'd say, sing a song. So we'd sing a song and they'd say to the missionary, write it down. The missionary would say, I can't do that. They'd say, what's wrong with you? Are you illiterate? Lady died here giving birth to triplets. They couldn't sing in church that Sunday. So, for the first time in history, somebody got up and Dinama took his flute, his bamboo flute, and said, I hope that what I'm going to do will bring our joy back once again. And what he's playing is their doxology, which says, Lord, we want to give you thanks, you three. And you hear they start humming with him. And this whole burden of sorrow from the baby, the mother dying, in the process of birth was removed, and then they began singing again. We'll skip this one. This is another group here. They wanted to sing an American song. This is what you do if you're thirsty and need a coconut break. They wanted to sing a song, so I had them sight read Jesus Loves Me, which was in their system. Kids 2.5, maybe 3 years old here, is going to have a little coconut milk for a break. Can you imagine in this country? I remember I told you about the kids that we started in music. So here are some of the first kids that started playing string instruments. I think the youngest one here is maybe 6 years old, going up to roughly 11 or so. So in our schools of music, we can study folk instrument, Ukraine. Folk instruments, piano, theory, singing, guitar, or the traditional orchestral instruments. When we went over, we found the professionals playing with violins and things where the strings were tied in knots because their strings were up to 10 years old. If they had a place to buy strings, they didn't have any money to buy it. Your full-time orchestra members, the professional orchestras, were getting a salary of $50 a month. I'm going to stick another one in here because I want you to hear these kids 10 years later. This is taken this last May. Stephen was asked to come over and direct the orchestra again. We thought it was going to be the adult group. And when he got there, we found out it wasn't the adult orchestra he was going to conduct, but the youth orchestra. So what you have here is roughly 100 singers and then the orchestra. You'll find a few older people in the orchestra where we happen to be short of instruments that time. These are pretty much just kids from the churches in Kyiv, the capital city. The music you hear in the background is our adult orchestra. First time they've ever played Baroque music. The kids said they want to do... The kids chose to do selections from the Messiah with 2 days rehearsal. That's not me, that's my son. We look a lot alike from the back, you know. Girl on the left is 13. That girl is 15 and the one next to her is 16. This is an Easter Sunday morning service. Following this performance, the national church leadership was so overwhelmed, they said they got to go on tour. So they rented two buses. Unfortunately, they needed three to take all the kids. So they decided on which two-thirds would go. The other third went and rented their own bus. They said, we're not staying home. And so they took off to Odessa, 400 miles, and they did the whole concert. Now, they only did like four selections from the Messiah. They did some other things, including a couple contemporary numbers, at least what they would call contemporary. And now, I think it's next week, they take off on another concert tour, which they don't call concerts, they call evangelizations. The kids are going, and the national church leadership is paying for it because they feel this is so important to kids to reach other kids for Christ. So you have pre-evangelism, evangelism, worship, discipleship, and evangelism by the nationals themselves, which is the circuit. We've got just a few minutes left for questions.
Can you tell us briefly what the lectures tomorrow will be? Matthew 28?
Yes, tomorrow I'm going to talk. A musician looks at Matthew 28, the Great Commission, or what some people refer to as the Great Commission. I think it's a misnomer. I don't care that people call it that, but I think it should be called something else. And I'll tell you why that isn't what it means. I have a pretty much a different view of that Great Commission than other people do. And so I'll share that in the first session. The second session, I'm going to talk about biblical mandates for music in the church, which will come out of the Matthew 28 presentation. And anything else you want is in between.